doomed enterprise. Occasionally they surprised everyone, appearing at a puja for a few hours with their two identical little girls, who barely looked Bengali and spoke only English, and were being raised so differently from me and most of the other children. They were not taken to Calcutta every summer. They did not have parents who were clinging to another way of life and exhorting their children to do the same. Because of Deborah, they were exempt from all that, and for this reason, I envied them. "Usha, look at you, all grown up and so pretty," Deborah would say whenever she saw me, rekindling, if only for a minute, our bond of years before. She had cut off her beautiful long hair by then, and had a bob. "I bet you'll be old enough to babysit soon," she would say. "I'll call you. The girls would love that." But she never did. I began to grow out of my girlhood, entering middle school and developing crushes on the American boys in my class. The crushes amounted to nothing. In spite of Deborah's compliments, I was always overlooked at that age. But my mother must have picked up on something, for she forbade me to attend the dances that were held the last Friday of every month in the school cafeteria, and it was an unspoken law that I was not allowed to date. "Don't think you'll get away with marrying an American the way Pranukaku did," she would say from time to time. I was 13, the thought of marriage irrelevant to my life. Still, her words upset me, and I felt her grip on me tighten. She would fly into a rage when I told her I wanted to start wearing a bra, or if I wanted to go to Harvard Square with a friend. In the middle of our arguments, she often conjured Deborah as her antithesis, the sort of woman she refused to be. "If she were your mother, she would let you do whatever you wanted, because she wouldn't care. Is that what you want, Usha? A mother who doesn't care?" When I began menstruating, the summer before I started ninth grade, my mother gave me a speech, telling me that I was to let no boy touch me, and then she asked if I knew how a woman became pregnant. I told her what I had been taught in science, about the sperm fertilizing the egg, and then she asked if I knew how, exactly, that happened. I saw the terror in her eyes, and so, though I knew that aspect of procreation as well, I lied, and told her it hadn't been explained to us. I began keeping other secrets from her, evading her with the aid of my friends. I told her I was sleeping over at a friend's when really I went to parties, drinking beer, and allowing boys to kiss me and fondle my breasts, and press their erections against my hip as we lay groping on a sofa or the backseat of a car. I began to pity my mother the older I got, the more I saw what a desolate life she led. She had never worked, and during the day she watched soap operas to pass the time. Her only job every day was to clean and cook for my father and me. We rarely went to restaurants, my father always pointing out, even in cheap ones, how expensive they were compared with eating at home. When my mother complained to him about how much she hated life in the suburbs and how lonely she felt, he said nothing to placate her. "If you are so unhappy, go back to Calcutta," he would offer, making it clear that their separation would not affect him one way or the other. I began to take my cues from my father in dealing with her, isolating her doubly. When she screamed at me for talking too long on the telephone or staying too long in my room, I learned to scream back, telling her that she was pathetic, that she knew nothing about me, and it was clear to us both that I had stopped needing her, definitively and abruptly, just as Pranukaku had. Then, the year before I went off to college, my parents and I were invited to the Chakraborty's home for Thanksgiving. We were not the only guests from my parents' old Cambridge crowd. It turned out that Pranukaku and Deborah wanted to have a sort of reunion of all the people they had been friendly with back then. Normally, my parents did not celebrate Thanksgiving. The ritual of a large sit-down dinner and the foods that one was supposed to eat was lost on them. They treated it as if it were Memorial Day or Veterans Day, just another holiday in the American year. But we drove out to Marblehead, to an impressive stone-faced house with a semicircular gravel driveway clogged with cars. The house was a short walk from the ocean. On our way, we had driven by the harbor overlooking the cold, glittering Atlantic, and when we stepped out of the car, we were greeted by the sound of gulls and waves. Most of the living room furniture had been moved to the basement, and extra tables joined to the main one to form a giant U. They were covered with tablecloths, set with white plates and silverware, and had centerpieces of gourds. I was struck by the toys and dolls that were everywhere. Dogs that shed long yellow hairs on everything, all the photographs of Bonnie and Sarah and Deborah decorating the walls, still more plastering the refrigerator door. Food was being prepared when we arrived, something my mother always frowned upon. the kitchen a chaos of people and smells and enormous dirtied bowls. Deborah's family, whom we remembered dimly from the wedding, was there. Her parents and her brothers and sisters, and their husbands and wives and boyfriends and babies. Her sisters were in their 30s, but like Deborah, they could have been mistaken for college students, wearing jeans and clogs and fisherman sweaters, and her brother Maddie, with whom I had danced in a circle at the wedding, was now a freshman at Amherst, with wide-set green eyes and wispy brown hair, and a complexion that reddened easily. As soon as I saw Deborah's siblings, joking with one another as they chopped and stirred things in the kitchen, I was furious with my mother for making a scene before we left the house and forcing me to wear a shalwar kameez. I knew they assumed from my clothing that I had more in common with the other Bengalis than with them. But Deborah insisted on including me, setting me to work peeling apples with Maddie, and out of my parents' sight, I was given beer to drink. When the meal was ready, we were told where to sit, in an alternating boy-girl formation that made the Bengalis uncomfortable. Bottles of wine were lined upon the table. Two turkeys were brought out, one stuffed with sausage and one without. My mouth watered at the food, but I knew afterward, on our way home, my mother would complain that it was all tasteless and bland. "Impossible," my mother said, shaking her hand over the top of her glass when someone tried to pour her a little wine. Deborah's father, Jean, got up to say grace and asked everyone at the table to join hands. He bowed his head and closed his eyes. "Dear Lord, we thank you today for the food we are about to receive," he began. My parents were seated next to each other, and I was stunned to see that they complied, that my father's brown fingers lightly clasped my mother's pale ones. I noticed Maddie seated on the other side of the room and saw him glancing at me as his father spoke. After the chorus of amens, Jean raised his glass and said, "Forgive me, but I never thought I'd have the opportunity to say this. Here's to Thanksgiving with the Indians." Only a few people laughed at the joke. Then Pranu Kaku stood up and thanked everyone for coming. He was relaxed from alcohol, his once wiry body beginning to thicken. He started to talk sentimentally about his early days in Cambridge, and then suddenly he recounted the story of meeting me and my mother for the first time, telling the guests about how he had followed us that afternoon. The people who did not know us laughed, amused by the description of the encounter and by Pranu Kaku's desperation. He walked around the room to where my mother was sitting and draped a lanky arm around her shoulder, forcing her, for a brief moment, to stand up. "This woman," he declared, pulling her close to his side, "this woman hosted my first real Thanksgiving in America. It might have been an afternoon in May, but that first meal at Bodhi's table was Thanksgiving to me. If it weren't for that meal, I would have gone back to Calcutta." My mother looked away, embarrassed. She was 38, already going gray, and she looked closer to my father's age than to Pranab Kaku's. Regardless of his waistline, he retained his handsome, carefree looks. Pranab Kaku went back to his place at the head of the table, next to Deborah, and concluded, "And if that had been the case, I'd had never have met you, my darling." And he kissed her on the mouth in front of everyone, to much applause, as if it were their wedding day all over again. After the turkey, smaller forks were distributed and orders were taken for three different kinds of pie, written on small pads by Deborah's sisters, as if they were waitresses. After dessert, the dogs needed to go out, and Pranab Kaku volunteered to take them. "How about a walk on the beach?" he suggested, and Deborah's side of the family agreed that that was an excellent idea. None of the Bengalis wanted to go, preferring to sit with their tea and cluster together, at last, at one end of the room, speaking freely after the forced chit-chat with the Americans during the meal. Maddie came over and sat in the chair beside me, that was now empty, encouraging me to join the walk. When I hesitated, pointing to my inappropriate clothes and shoes, but also aware of my mother's silent fury at the sight of us together, he said, "I'm sure Deb can lend you something." So I went upstairs where Deborah gave me a pair of her jeans and a thick sweater and some sneakers, so that I looked like her and her sisters. She sat on the edge of the bed, watching me change, as if we were girlfriends, and then she asked if I had a boyfriend. When I told her no, she said, "Maddie thinks you're cute." "He told you?" "No, but I can tell." As I walked back downstairs, emboldened by this information, in the jeans I had to roll up and in which I finally felt like myself, I noticed my mother lift her eyes from her teacup and stare at me, but she said nothing, and off I went, with Pranab Kaku and his dogs and his in-laws, along a road and then down some steep wooden steps to the water. Deborah and one of her sisters stayed behind to begin the cleanup and see to the needs of those who remained. Initially, we all walked together, in a single row across the sand. But then I noticed Maddie hanging back, and so the two of us trailed behind, the distance between us and the others increasing. We began flirting, talking of things I no longer remember, and eventually we wandered into a rocky inlet and Maddie fished a joint out of his pocket. We turned our backs to the wind and smoked it, our cold fingers touching in the process, our lips pressed to the same damp section of the rolling paper. At first I didn't feel any effect, but then, listening to him talk about the band he was in, I was aware that his voice sounded miles away, and that I had the urge to laugh, even though what he was saying was not terribly funny. It felt as if we were apart from the group for hours, but when we wandered back to the sand we could still see them, walking out onto a promontory to watch the sunset. It was dark by the time we all headed back to the house, and I dreaded seeing my parents while I was still high. But when we got there, Deborah told me that my parents, feeling tired, had left, agreeing to let someone drive me home later. A fire had been lit, and I was told to relax and have more pie as the leftovers were put away and the living room slowly put back in order. Of course, it was Maddie who drove me home. And sitting in my parents' driveway, I kissed him, at once thrilled and terrified that my mother might walk onto the lawn in her nightgown and discover us. I gave Maddie my phone number, and for a few weeks, I thought of him constantly and hoped foolishly that he would call. In the end, my mother was right, and 14 years after Thanksgiving, after 23 years of marriage, Pranab Kaku and Deborah got divorced. It was he who had strayed, falling in love with a married Bengali woman, destroying two families in the process. The other woman was someone my parents knew, though not very well. Deborah was in her 40s by then, Bonnie and Sarah away at college. In her shock and grief, it was my mother whom Deborah turned to, calling and weeping into the phone. Somehow, through all the years, she had continued to regard us as quasi-in-laws, sending flowers when my grandparents died, and giving me a compact edition of the OED as a college graduation present. "You knew him so well. How could he do something like this?" Deborah asked my mother. And then, "Did you know anything about it?" My mother answered truthfully that she did not. Their hearts had been broken by the same man, only my mother's had long ago mended. And in an odd way, as my parents approached their old age, she and my father had grown fond of each other, out of habit if nothing else. I believe my absence from the house, once I left for college, had something to do with this, because over the years when I visited, I noticed a warmth between my parents that had not been there before, a quiet teasing, a solidarity, a concern when one of them fell ill. My mother and I had also made peace. She had accepted the fact that I was not only her daughter, but a child of America as well. Slowly, she accepted that I dated one American man, and then another, and then yet another, that I slept with them, and even that I lived with one, though we were not married. She welcomed my boyfriends into our home, and when things didn't work out, she told me I would find someone better. After years of being idle, she decided, when she turned 50, to get a degree in library science at a nearby university. On the phone, Deborah admitted something that surprised my mother, that all these years she had felt hopelessly shut out of a part of Pranab Kaku's life. "I was so horribly jealous of you back then, for knowing him, understanding him in a way I never could. He turned his back on his family, on all of you, really. But I still felt threatened. I could never get over that." She told my mother that she had tried for years to get Pranab Kaku to reconcile with his parents, and that she had also encouraged him to maintain ties with other Bengalis, but he had resisted. It had been Deborah's idea to invite us to their Thanksgiving. Ironically, the other woman had been there too. "I hope you don't blame me for taking him away from your lives, Bodhi. I always worried that you did." My mother assured Deborah that she blamed her for nothing. She confessed nothing to Deborah about her own jealousy of decades before, only that she was sorry for what happened, that it was a sad and terrible thing for their family. She did not tell Deborah that a few weeks after Pranam Kaku's wedding, while I was at a Girl Scout meeting and my father was at work, she had gone through the house, gathering up all the safety pins that lurked in drawers and tins, and added them to the few fastened to her bracelets. When she'd found enough, she pinned them to her sari one by one, attaching the front piece to the layer of material underneath, so that no one would be able to pull the garment off her body. Then she took a can of lighter fluid and a box of kitchen matches and stepped outside into our chilly backyard, which was full of leaves needing to be raked. Over her sari, she was wearing a knee-length lilac trench coat, and to any neighbor, she must have looked as though she simply stepped out for some fresh air. She opened up the coat and removed the tip from the can of the lighter fluid and doused herself, then buttoned and belted the coat. She walked over to the garbage barrel behind our house and disposed of the fluid, then returned to the middle of the yard with a box of matches in her coat pocket. For nearly an hour, she stood there, looking at our house, trying to work up the courage to strike a match. It was not I who saved her or my father, but our next-door neighbor, Mrs. Holcomb, with whom my mother had never been particularly friendly. She came out to rake the leaves in her yard, calling out to my mother and remarking how beautiful the sunset was. "I see you've been admiring it for a while now," she said. My mother agreed, and then she went back into the house. By the time my father and I came home in the early evening, she was in the kitchen boiling rice for our dinner, as if it were any other day. My mother told Deborah none of this. It was to me that she confessed, after my own heart was broken by a man I'd hoped to marry.
A choice of accommodations. From the outside, the hotel looked promising, like an old ski lodge in the mountains. Chocolate brown siding, a steeply pitched roof, red trim around the windows. But as soon as they entered the lobby of the Chadwick Inn, Amit was disappointed. The place was without character, renovated in pastel colors, squiggly gray lines a part of the wallpaper's design as if someone had repeatedly been testing the ink in a pen and ultimately had nothing to say. By the front desk, a revolving brass rack was filled with tourist brochures about the Berkshires, and Megan grabbed a handful as Amit checked in. Now the brochures were scattered across one of the two double beds in their room. Megan unfolded the cover of a brochure to reveal a map. "Where are we exactly?" she asked, her finger trailing too far to the north. "Here," Amit said, pointing to the town. "There's the lake, see? The one that looks sort of like a rabbit?" "I don't see it," Megan said. "Right here." Amit took Megan's finger and drew it firmly to the spot. "I mean, I don't get how the lake's supposed to look like a rabbit." It had been a long drive from New York, and Amit was in the mood for a drink. But there was no minibar, and no room service. The two double beds were covered in flowery maroon quilts, and across from them a wide dresser held a television set at its center. A small paper pyramid sat on a square table between the beds, listing the local cable channels. The only pleasant feature in the room was a cathedral ceiling with exposed beams. In spite of this, the room was dark. Even with the curtains to the balcony drawn apart, all the lights needed to be turned on. They were here for Pam Borden's wedding, which was to take place that evening at Langford Academy, a boarding school where Pam's father was headmaster and from where Amit had graduated 18 years ago. There had been an option to sleep for $20 a person at one of the Langford dorms, empty now because it was August. But Amit had decided to splurge on the Chadwick Inn, which was slightly removed from campus and offered a pool, a tennis court, a restaurant with 2 stars, and access to the shaded lake in which he'd been taught as a teenager to kayak and canoe. Talking it over with Megan, they agreed to drop off the girls at her parents' place on Long Island and book a room for both Saturday and Sunday, making a short vacation out of Pam's wedding, just the two of them. Amit unlocked the sliding glass door and stepped out onto the balcony, a strip of cement containing 2 plastic chairs. The northeast was in the middle of a heat wave, and even up in the mountains it was sultry, but the purity of the air with its sharp scent of pine felt restorative. He was unsettled by how quiet it was. No little girls' voices calling out to one another, no reprimands or endearments coming from Megan. The car ride had been the same, Megan asleep, the back seat empty, even though he kept looking in the rearview mirror, expecting to see his daughter's faces as they dozed or quarreled or chewed on bagels. He sat down now in one of the chairs, which was not very comfortable. He felt cheated. "I can't believe they charged $250 a night for this," he said. "It's crazy," Megan said, joining him. "But I guess they can get away with it, given that we're in the middle of nowhere." It was true they were in the middle of nowhere, though he did not feel the same way. He'd known without having to review a map which roads to take after exiting the highway, remembered which direction the town was in. But he had never been to this hotel. His parents had not stayed here for parents' weekends. When Amit was at Langford, they had lived in India, in New Delhi. They hadn't made it to his graduation, either. They'd been planning to, but Amit's father, an ophthalmologist at one of Delhi's best hospitals, was requested to perform cataract surgery on a member of parliament, and so Bengali acquaintances of his parents from Worcester attended in their stead. After graduating, Amit had not kept in touch with his Langford friends. He had no nostalgia for the school, and when letters came seeking alumni contributions or inviting him to the succession of reunions, he threw them out without opening them. Apart from his loose connection with Pam and a sweatshirt he still owned with the school's wrinkled name across the chest, there was nothing to remind him of those years of his life. He couldn't imagine sending his daughters to Langford, couldn't imagine letting go of them as his parents had let go of him. He looked out at the hotel grounds. A pine tree growing directly in front of their balcony obstructed most of the immediate view. The pool was small and uninviting, surrounded by a chain-link fence with no one swimming or sunbathing on its periphery. To the right were the tennis courts, concealed by more pine trees, but he could hear the soft thwack of a ball flying back and forth, a sound that made him tired. "It's a shame about this tree," he said. "If only it were a few feet that way," Megan agreed. "Maybe we should ask for another room. It wouldn't be the first time." Amit and Megan had a tradition in their relationship of switching hotel rooms. On the first trip they'd taken together after they met to Puerto Rico, they'd gotten a room on the ground floor and there was a dead lizard in the bathroom. Megan complained, and they were switched to a deluxe suite overlooking the mesmerizing blue-green ocean and the contrasting blue of the sky. For the entirety of their stay, they kept the curtains open to that view, making love sideways on the bed as they faced it, waking to it in the mornings, the effect being as if the whole room and the bed and they themselves were somehow afloat on the sea. A similar thing had happened in Venice, where they'd gone to celebrate their first anniversary. After one night facing a stone wall, they moved to a room by a canal where a small barge docked each morning, selling fruits and vegetables. In this case, Amit reflected, they were already on the desirable side of the hotel. The rooms at the front would overlook the parking lot. "It's not worth it just for two nights," Megan said. She leaned slightly forward in her chair and peered over the railing of the balcony, craning her neck. "Is the wedding here at the hotel?" "I told you, it's at Langford." "Well, another couple is about to get married in that gazebo. I see bridesmaids." Amit looked on the other side of the pine tree and saw people filing out along a flagstone path that led from the terrace of the hotel restaurant. A photographer leaned over a tripod surrounded by bags of equipment, and in front of him, a group of young women posed in matching lavender dresses. "Pam's wedding will be different," he said. "What do you mean?" "She won't have bridesmaids." "How do you know?" "She's not the type." "You never know," Megan said. "A lot of women do things that are out of character on their wedding day. Even women like Pam." Her slight derision washed over him, not penetrating. He knew Megan had been surprised that he'd accepted the invitation to Pam's wedding, given that he and Pam rarely saw each other. And though Megan hadn't protested, he understood that on some level he had dragged her here, to an unfamiliar place full of unfamiliar people, to a piece of his past that had nothing to do with the life he and Megan shared. He knew that though Megan refused to admit it, she was insecure about Pam, defensive the one or two times they'd met, as if Amit and Pam had once been lovers. When Amit and Megan had first met, they traded their histories, divulging the succession of romantic interests that led them to each other, but he'd never mentioned Pam in that context. He had loved her, it was true, but because she'd never been his girlfriend, there had been nothing to explain. He slouched in his chair, resting his neck on the hard plastic edge, and shut his eyes.
"I could use a drink."
They stepped back into the air-conditioned room, and he opened the suitcase that they were sharing for the weekend. He pulled out the thick envelope containing the invitation, directions, a small map of Langford's campus with the ceremony, and reception locations marked with a highlighter. He sat on the bed, leaning against a pile of extremely soft pillows, sinking down. Then he looked at the digital clock that was beside the paper pyramid on the bedside table.
"The wedding starts in an hour. We should get pillows like this at home."
"Then we better get ready." Megan regarded him with a look of professional concern, as if he were a patient on her rounds.
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing. I was just hoping we'd have some time beforehand to go for a walk or swim in the lake.
I was thinking about a swim all the way up here. I didn't think the traffic would be so bad.
We'll swim tomorrow, she said. We have a whole weekend.
He nodded. Right. He stood up and went into the bathroom to shave and to shower. These everyday rituals felt like a chore. He was uninspired to put on his suit and socialize with ghosts from his adolescence. He undressed, then stood in front of the mirror, spreading shaving cream on his face. Since Monica's birth 3 years ago, this was their first trip without either of the girls. They were overdue for a vacation. Normally, every summer they rented a cabin for 2 weeks in the Adirondacks, but Megan was in the last year of her residency at Mount Sinai, and her schedule did not allow it. She just finished a rotation in the cardiac intensive care unit, working 36-hour shifts, returning to the apartment at dawn, falling asleep just as Amit and the girls were beginning their day. Amit, who worked as the managing editor for a medical journal, had a more flexible schedule. Summer was a slow time at the journal, and since June, he'd been overseeing the girls' breakfasts and baths, scheduling play dates, dropping Maya off at day camp in the mornings and picking her up again. Reducing their nanny's hours for the summer months was one of the ways he and Megan had decided to cut back on expenses. The down payment on their new apartment, two stories of a brownstone on West 75th Street, had depleted their savings. He sensed Megan's relief at not having Maya and Monica around, at being free. Amit wanted to share that relief, that sense of escape he'd been looking forward to all summer after the invitation to Pam's wedding had come and they'd made their plan. But now that they were alone, he was nagged by the thought of Monica's runny nose and wondered if his mother-in-law would remember that strawberries gave Maya a rash. He was tempted to ask Megan, but he stopped himself, knowing that she would accuse him of not trusting his in-laws. As a parent, she was less fussy, less cautious than he was. On her days off, she indulged them, baking with them in the kitchen, not minding if they skipped dinner because they were too full of cookies and cake. He knew that it was partly out of guilt that she tended to be lenient, but it was also her nature. She had not been horrified as he had when Maya had found a wad of flattened chewing gum on the playground and put it into her mouth, or when Monica wandered off during a picnic they were having in Central Park and began playing with her tiny fingers with dog shit. Megan laughed at such moments, wiping off their hands and faces, convinced that her children could survive anything. She spent her days with people who were fighting for their lives and could not be shaken by a scraped elbow or 100-degree fever. It was Amit, who had studied enough about the body to know its inherent fragility, who had dissected enough cadavers to know what a horizontal chest incision would reveal, who was plagued by his daughter's vulnerability, both to illness and to accidents of all kinds. He was still haunted by an incident in the cafeteria of the Museum of Natural History when Monica, a year old, had nearly choked on a piece of dried apricot. A woman at a neighboring table who happened to be a nurse had leapt up at the sound of Monica's coughing and efficiently swept her finger through the girl's mouth. In spite of 2 years of medical school, Amit lacked the simple instinct, the confidence to do such a thing. He had been unable to look at either of his daughters for the rest of the day, to enjoy their time at the museum. He kept picturing the apricot piece lodged in Monica's windpipe and how it might have silenced her forever. When he read articles in the newspaper about taxis suddenly swerving onto sidewalks and killing half a dozen pedestrians, it was always himself he pictured, holding Monica and Maya by the hand. Or he imagined a wave at Jones Beach where he had been taking them once a week during the summer, dragging one of them down, or a pile of sand suffocating them as he was flipping a few feet away through a magazine. In each of these scenarios, he saw himself surviving, the girls perishing under his supervision. Megan would blame him, naturally, and then she would divorce him, and all of it, his life with her and the girls, would end. A brief glance in the wrong direction, he knew, could toss his existence over a cliff. He lay down his razor and turned on the shower to warm up the room. He heard a knock, and then Megan opened the door. "I can't go to the wedding," she said, shaking her head. She said this definitively, the way she told the girls that they weren't allowed to watch another program on television or spend another 5 minutes in the tub. "What are you talking about?" "Look," she said, pointing to the skirt she'd put on. Above it, she wore only her bra, flesh-colored and dingy at the straps. The skirt reached her ankles and it was made of a diaphanous, smoky gray material, layered over a silk panel of a slightly darker shade. She held up a section, and his eyes went immediately to a spot in the fabric. At first he thought it was a stain, but then he realized it was a burn,
that had created a small empty patch charred around the edges. Beneath it, the silk lining looked unsightly, like the bright flesh exposed when a scab is forcibly lifted away. "It looks awful," she said. "There's no way to hide it. Did you pack a spare outfit?" She shook her head, looking at him with annoyance. "Did you?" Amit wiped his hands on a towel and sat on the lid of the toilet seat. Running his hands between the two layers of fabric, he felt the gauzy material brushing his palm, the silk at the back of his fingers. In medical school, he'd considered being a surgeon, learning to piece together the most minuscule tissues of the body. But he'd never made it to any rotations, had only learned from textbooks and labs. As far as he could see, there was no hope for repairing the skirt. It was so simple, so sheer, that the missing patch through which the pad of one of his fingers was now visible had ruined it. "I can't believe I didn't notice when I was packing," Megan said. "It must have happened the last time I wore it, sparks from a cigarette or something." He knew it wasn't her fault, and yet he couldn't stop himself from blaming her a little, for not paying closer attention. And he couldn't help but wonder if it was an unconscious move on her part to avoid Pam's wedding, to sabotage things. It occurred to him that with the excuse of Megan's skirt, they might blow off the wedding altogether and spend the night in the hotel watching movies in bed. Their absence would go unnoticed in such a big crowd, their place settings ignored as the waiters circled the tables. Had the Chadwick Inn been nicer, he might have been tempted. "Is there a store nearby?" Megan asked. "Somewhere I could dash out and buy something else while you get ready?" "There used to be a mall, but it was about an hour's drive from here. I don't remember any clothing stores in town, not nice ones." She turned the skirt to one side so that the burn was no longer visible from the front. Then she stood beside him in front of the mirror over the sink, their bare arms touching. Normally, Megan did not wear makeup, but for the occasion, she had painted her mouth with a reddish lipstick. He found it distracting, preferred the intelligent, old-fashioned beauty of her face. It was the face of someone he could imagine living in a previous era, a simpler time, in an America that was oblivious to India altogether. Her dark brown hair was wound up as always, pulled away without fuss from her face and her long, pale neck. She wore glasses, frameless oval lenses that seemed necessary to protect her sensitive gaze. They were the same height, 5'9", tall for a woman but short for a man, and she was 5 years older, 42. And yet, of the two of them, it was Amit who already looked at first glance middle-aged, for by the age of 21, his hair had turned completely gray. It was here at Langford that it had begun, when he was in the sixth form. At first, it was just a few strands, well concealed in his black hair. But by the time he was a junior at Columbia, it was the black hairs he could count on one hand. He'd read it was possible after a traumatic experience for a person's hair to turn gray in youth. But there had been no sudden death he could point to, no accident, no profound life change apart from his parents sending him to Langford. "I suppose if you stood right next to me all night, no one would notice," Megan said, pressing up against him. He felt the warmth of her arms and a twitch of desire too mired by exhaustion to act upon. "Do you really think you can survive a whole evening without leaving my side?" he asked her. "I can if you can." There was a note of challenge in her voice, and Amit smiled, amused by the idea, motivated to go to the wedding now that he would have a specific task to perform. At the same time, he thought that in the early days of their love, this would not have been an issue, their bodies continuously touching through the course of an evening, something that would have been taken for granted. "It's a deal," he said. They looked at their reflections in the mirror. She in her torn skirt and dingy bra, he naked, his penis flaccid, his face covered with bright white shaving cream. Megan shook her head. "What a vision we'll be." He'd assumed they'd walk to the school. It was just across the road, a few minutes over a sloping field. But Megan was wearing heels and didn't want to get them muddy, so they got into the car. The seats were still full of evidence of their daughters. Abandoned books, tiny dolls, the plastic horses Maya had begun collecting. Only the car seats were gone, transferred into his in-law's car for the weekend. He thought of the girls now at their grandparents playing in the treehouse his father-in-law had built for their occasional visits, his mother-in-law providing slices of pound cake and juice boxes for a tea party. His daughters looked nothing like him, nothing like his family, and in spite of the distance Amit felt from his parents, this fact bothered him, that his mother and father had passed down nothing physically to his children. Both Maya and Monica had inherited Megan's coloring without a trace of Amit's deeply tan skin and black eyes, so that apart from their vaguely Indian names, they appeared fully American.
"Are they yours?"
people sometimes asked when he was alone with them in stores or at the playground in the park. After just 2 minutes, they pulled off the road and turned up the wide, tree-lined drive that led to the gates of the school. The leaves were glossy and abundant, but his memories were of the blazing branches of autumn and the purplish light of the mountains, the shadows that spread in their curves and dips, and the snow that covered the tops of the gates in winter. The school itself was more or less as he remembered it, embarrassingly large and well-maintained, pieces of rounded abstract sculpture here and there on the grass.
"This place is nicer than where I went to college," Megan said, as they walked across the campus, taking in the pristine buildings, the sculptures.
"It's a bit over the top," he said. When they'd first met, Megan had been impressed by his prep school education, but at the same time, she'd teased him about it. She was not bitter towards the privilege, but she was sometimes judgmental. Were he not Indian, Megan would have probably avoided someone like him. She was the youngest of five children, her father a policeman, her mother a kindergarten teacher. She'd gotten a job after graduating from high school in a photocopy store during the days and as a telemarketer in the evenings, not beginning college until she was 20, going part-time because she had to continue working. In that sense, she worked harder than anyone he'd ever known, including his own father and his parents' uniformly successful crowd of Bengali friends. Megan's ordinary background had displeased his parents, as had the fact that she was 5 years older than he was. Her stark prettiness, her refusal to wear contact lenses, her height had not charmed them. The fact that she was a doctor did not make up for it. If anything, it made their disappointment in Amit worse. He noticed new wings tacked onto some of the buildings, modern elements of steel and glass alongside the brick and white cupolas. His parents had plucked him out of public school in Winchester, Massachusetts, where he'd been raised, and sent him here, for they decided when Amit was in the eighth grade to move back to India. He still remembered the night his parents told him their plans. They were sitting in a seafood restaurant on the Cape in Kotuit, overlooking the water, the table heaped with the bright red claws and shells from which his father had effortlessly extracted the meat for all of them. His father began by saying he was growing restless on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, that there was a hospital in Delhi where he believed he was needed. Amit had been stunned by his parents' decision. His parents, unlike most other Bengalis in Massachusetts, had always been dismissive, even critical of India, never homesick or sentimental. His mother had short hair and wore trousers, putting on saris only for special occasions. His father kept a liquor cabinet and liked gin and tonic before his meals. They both came from wealthy families, had both summered in hill stations, and attended boarding schools in India themselves. The relative affluence of America never impressed them. In many ways, they had lived more privileged lives in India. But they left the country and had not looked back. At the restaurant, his father pulled out the admissions packet for Langford, showing photographs of the campus, smiling students gathered around classroom tables, teachers standing in front of blackboards, caught mid-sentence by the camera's lens. Academically, it was far superior to the school he'd been attending, his father told him, mentioning the percentage of Langford graduates who went on to Ivy League colleges. Amit realized as his father spoke that the position in Delhi had been accepted, their house in Winchester already put up for sale. There was no question of his going to school in Delhi. It wasn't worth the trouble to adjust to education in a different country, his father said, given that eventually Amit would be attending an American college. From Langford during Christmas after each academic year came to an end, Amit went to Delhi to be with his parents, staying in their flat full of servants in Chittaranjan Park, in a barren room set aside for his stays. He never enjoyed his visits to Delhi, his broken Bengali of no use in that city. It made him miss Calcutta, where all his relatives lived, where he was used to going. His parents had moved to Delhi the year of Indira Gandhi's assassination, and the riots that subsequently raged there, the curfews and the constant vigilance with which his parents had to live, meant that Amit remained cooped up inside, without friends, without anything to do. In that sense, it was a relief to him to return to this peaceful town. 4 years later, his parents were back in America, moving to Houston. In Delhi, his father had perfected a laser technique to correct astigmatism, that earned him invitations to work and teach in hospitals all over the world. After 5 years in Houston, they'd moved yet again to Lausanne, Switzerland. They lived in Saudi Arabia now. At Langford, Amit was the only Indian student, and people always assumed that he'd been born and raised in that country and not in Massachusetts. They complimented him on his accent, always telling him how good his English was. He'd arrived when he was 15 for sophomore year, which at Langford was called the fourth form, and by that time, friendships and alliances among the boys of his class were already in place. At his high school in Winchester, he'd been a star student, but suddenly, he'd had to work doggedly to maintain his grades. He had to wear a jacket every morning to his classes and call his teachers masters and attend chapel on Sundays. Quickly he learned that his parents' wealth was laughable compared to the majority of Langford boys. There was no escape at the end of the day. And though he admitted it to no one, especially not his parents when they called from Delhi every weekend, he was crippled with homesickness, missing his parents to the point where tears often filled his eyes in those first months without warning. He sought traces of his parents' faces and voices amongst the people who surrounded and cared for him, but there was absolutely nothing, no one at Langford to remind him of them. After that first semester, he had slipped as best as he could into this world, swimming competitively, calling boys by their last names, always wearing khakis because jeans were not allowed. He learned to live without his mother and father as everyone else did, shedding his daily dependence on them even though he was still a boy, and even to enjoy it. Still, he refused to forgive them. Every Thanksgiving, he and the other students who had nowhere to go were taken in by Pam's family, boys who were from Santiago and Tehran and other troubled parts of the world, or were the sons of diplomats and journalists who moved around even more frequently than Amit's parents. They would eat in the Borden's house, located at one end of the campus with Pam and her three brothers, all of whom went to different boarding schools, but always came home for the holidays. For Amit, it was the highlight of each year. He and all the other boys were in love with Pam, who was the only girl in her family, the only girl on campus, the only girl it had felt back then in the world. They would pray to be seated close to her at the table, and for weeks afterward they would talk about her, imagining her life at Northfield Mount Hermon, imagining what her breasts looked like, or the feel of her light brown poker straight hair, wondering what it was like in the morning messily trailing over her back. They wondered about the room upstairs where Pam slept when she came home. They noticed if she ate white meat or dark, and they noticed the year she did not eat any turkey at all. She seemed fully aware of their admiration, flattered but off limits. She was that rare, unsettling thing. A teenage girl already conscious of her power over men, while at the same time uninterested in them. She was comfortable with the opposite sex in a way most girls were not, perhaps because she'd grown up in a house full of boys. The Bordens were forthright people, all of them, even the children, trained to act as friendly hosts for students who washed up at their holiday table. Pam would talk to Amit and the others, asking each of them about their courses, as if she were her mother's age and not a girl of 15. And then they would disappear from her consciousness until the following year. After the meal, Headmaster Borden would take them out onto the lawn for a game of touch football with Pam's brothers. Or they stayed inside, where Mrs. Borden, who taught French at the school, would conduct complicated word games or charades. In his final year at Langford, Amit was admitted to Columbia University. No one else from his class was going there, but then one day, Headmaster Borden told Amit that Pam had decided on Columbia too. "Keep an eye on her for me," the headmaster said. But it was Pam who'd called first in that same ambassadorial way her parents had, even though New York City and the world of college was as foreign to her as it was to him. Suddenly, because she had decided so, they were friends. They would go to dinner twice a week after the religion class they took together, either to Café Pertuti treating themselves to creamy plates of pasta, or to La Rosita for café con leche and rice and beans. After that, they would study in the same small room in Butler Library, sitting across from each other on armchairs, reading Milton and Marx. Odd things made him love her. The fact that she never put her books into a backpack or a bag, hugging them instead against her chest. That she always appeared somehow underdressed, still wearing a fringed suede jacket at a time of year when everyone else was bundled in wool and down. That the last two letters in her name were the first two in his.
a silly thing he never mentioned to her, but caused him to believe that they were bound together.
He'd wondered at first if it was romantic, but quickly realized that she was involved in affairs, that he was just a friend. She was used to being surrounded by men who, like her brothers, were protective of her, loyal to her, who paid court without seducing her. And she had appointed Amit to play that role while they were in college. She would ask him to investigate boys she was curious about, learning about their reputations, their history, before deciding whether to pursue them. In exchange, she would give him advice on how to approach other girls, how most effectively to flirt with them. It was Pam who had coached Amit through his first college relationship with Ellen Craddock, going out of her way and befriending Ellen just for the sake of being able to throw her and Amit together on college walk. Only once had Amit worked up the nerve to make a pass at Pam, in their sophomore year, kissing her after getting drunk at a party and putting his hand on her breast, on top of a dark green turtleneck sweater she was wearing. She had kissed him back, allowed him to touch her, but then she'd drawn away as if she'd known all along that one day this would happen. "Now we know what that feels like," she told him. And he knew then that it was impossible that she did not like him in that way. She had indulged him, just as her family had indulged him once a year in their home, offering a small piece of herself and then shutting the door. Although Pam still lived in New York, selling foreign rights at a literary agency these days, they saw each other at best once or twice a year, usually by accident, on a subway or a street corner or a crowded exhibit at the Metropolitan. But he was permanently on her mailing list, and therefore he received cards at Christmas and even on his birthday. She was the type to remember that sort of thing. When she learned that Amit and Megan had gotten married, she sent them candlesticks from Tiffany's. And when the girls were born, expensive gifts arrived. European dresses and cashmere blankets for their strollers. There had been no phone call from her to tell him she was getting married, only the invitation. And after all these years, Amit felt both quietly elated and solicitous, as contact from Pam and the Bordens had always made him feel, causing him to set aside whatever it was that he was doing and pay them his full attention. Guests were gathered under a beautiful tree where a bar had been set up, offering cocktails before the ceremony. On the lawn were rows of white folding chairs overlooking the deceptively gentle milky blue mountains. Over them, the sun was just beginning to set. It was here at this precise spot that he'd graduated. He looked different that day, leaner in frame, his hair still predominantly black. It was Pam in college who'd forbidden him to color it, telling him it was distinguished, that women would be drawn to it. He hadn't believed her, but she was right. Every woman he'd ever been involved with had confessed at one point or another that they found his gray hair sexy. "Other side," Megan said as they approached the crowd. He moved over to her left and matched his stride to hers. Side by side, they took their place in the line for drinks. There was the usual array of bottles and two punch bowls full of lemonade. "Spiked or unspiked?" the bartender asked. They got two glasses of the spiked and approached the lawn, sipping their sweet, potent drinks. He looked around at the faces, at men carrying toddlers on their shoulders, mothers shushing babies in their carriers, nannies chasing after older children. The nannies seemed young, high school students, he guessed, hired for the occasion. The fathers were pointing to the trees, to the clouds that spread and shifted over the valley. He recognized no one and missed his daughters. "Lots of kids here," Megan said. "The girls would have enjoyed this. But then we wouldn't be able to enjoy ourselves. Cheers."
"Cheers."
Because they were standing side by side, they raised their glasses into the air in front of them without looking at each other. It felt strange to be drinking at the school. He remembered the covert parties, the bottles that would be smuggled into the dorms and consumed Friday and Saturday nights, always fearful of the proctor's rounds. "I feel old," he said to Megan. He saw a face that was familiar smiling at him walking over. The stylish tortoise-shell glasses were new, but he remembered the friendly blue eyes, the wavy brown hair, the cleft in the chin. They had shared a number of classes, been lab partners, he suddenly remembered, in chemistry. His father and Pam's father had grown up together. He had always referred to the headmaster as Uncle Borden. He remembered the last name, Schultz, but not the first.
"Sarkar,"
Schultz said.
"Amit Sarkar, right?"
Amit extended a hand.
Schultz's first name coming to him just then. Great to see you. This is my wife, Megan. Megan, this is Tim. The smile disappeared from Schultz's face. It's Ted.
Ted.
Of course, Ted. I'm so sorry. Ted, meet my wife, Megan. He felt like an idiot, as mortified by his error as he would have been in his first term at Langford, when he worked so hard to please. He berated himself for using a name at all, for not letting it emerge naturally in the course of conversation. I'm sorry, he said again, as Ted and Megan shook hands. It's been a long day, a long drive. Don't worry about it, Ted said, in a way that only made Amit feel worse. Your parents still in India? They came back and then they left again. Where are you living these days? It turned out that Ted lived in Manhattan, too. He was divorced and working at a law firm. Do you guys know this guy Pam's marrying, the one she's finally going to settle for instead of one of us? I've never met Ryan, Amit said, wondering what Megan would make of Ted's comment. All I know is he writes for television, Ted said. One of those law shows that makes my job look glamorous. That's why they're moving to L.A. Apparently one of the actors for the show is supposed to be here. They looked around for someone who might be a celebrity. It was an attractive crowd. Many of the women in black cocktail dresses. Amit remembered Megan's skirt and took a step toward her, putting his arm around her waist.
So how did you two meet? Ted asked.
Med school, Megan said.
Oh, Dr. Sarkar, I'm impressed.
Just her, Amit said. She stuck it out, I didn't. A string quartet began to play and people drifted towards their seats. Amit and Megan chose chairs at the back, Megan complaining that her heels were sinking into the grass. They put their empty glasses under their seats. Everyone turned around as the man Pam was about to marry walked between the chairs and took his place at the center where a clergyman was standing. Ryan looked well into his 40s, tall, tanned with a salt and pepper beard, his handsome features lined. And then Pam appeared, coming down the aisle with her father, then her mother, and her brothers behind. Mrs. Borden was unchanged, her cropped sandy hair styled in the same practical way, her figure still trim. She turned her head to smile reassuringly at the guests on either side of her. All their lives, the Bordens had presided over similarly large gatherings, weekly assemblies and homecoming games and graduations, and in a way, this was no different. The only person he didn't recognize was a girl of about 12 or so with a long, pretty face and a somber expression carrying a bouquet of flowers. He guessed it was one of Pam's nieces or younger cousins. Pam wore a sleeveless dress with a train made of crumpled ivory material. The effect was not so much a dress as a long bed sheet that she had wrapped around herself, a careless yet perfect vision. She carried yellow freesias casually in one hand, smiling and waving to people with the other. To this day, she was the most beautiful woman he had ever known. The couple stood with their backs to the guests, facing the minister and the mountains and the setting sun. It was a brief, simple ceremony without bridesmaids or a best man, as Amit had predicted. Someone got up and read a poem he could not hear because there was no microphone. Still, visually, it was spectacular. The sky deepening into a combination of dark peach and plum over the mountains, the lush grounds of the school unpopulated save for the spot where the wedding was taking place. He watched strands of Pam's hair loosened by the wind that had settled over them, causing women to put shawls around their shoulders, that cold mountain air that always replaced the day's heat. She was 37 now, his age, but from the back she looked like a girl of 19. And yet she was marrying late, so much later than he had. As he witnessed the ceremony, he felt grateful for the faint connection he and Pam had maintained, enough for him to be sitting there watching her marry, witnessing the very beginning of that phase of her existence. Amit anticipated only a continuation of the things he knew. Megan, his job, life in New York, the girls. The most profound thing, having Maya and Monica, had already happened. Nothing would be more life-altering than that. He wanted to change none of it, and yet a part of him sometimes longed to return to the beginning of his relationship with Megan, if only for the pleasure of anticipating and experiencing those things again. There was a round of applause as Pam and Ryan kissed, their eyes opened from the excitement. And then the music started up and the wedding party receded down the grassy aisle. Amit rose, this time positioning himself on Megan's left without having to be told, and together they took their places behind the others in the receiving line. Pam tossed back her head and laughed at things people said, leaning over to kiss them or put a hand comfortingly to their upper arms.
"Where are your beautiful little girls?" she cried out as soon as she saw Amit, extending her neck so that he could kiss her on one cheek, then the other. Her skin was the same, disconcertingly soft, but now that he faced her, he saw Mrs. Borden's crow's feet forming around her eyes. "We left them with Megan's parents. It's our weekend of reckless freedom. I want to stay up until 5 in the morning, Megan announced cheerfully. "I want to celebrate all night and watch the sunrise from our balcony." Amit glanced at Megan, puzzled that she'd never mentioned this to him. He had assumed her main objective for the weekend was to sleep undisturbed.
"You do?"
Megan didn't answer him. Instead, she said to Pam, "You look lovely. It's such a pretty dress." She said this genuinely, not intimidated by Pam as she had been in the past. Amit wondered if it was because Pam was married now, belonging to another man and therefore not even a little bit to Amit. They shook hands with Ryan. "Pam's told me so much about you," Ryan said to Amit.
"Congratulations," Amit replied.
"All the best. We'll see if I can make a California girl out of her."
"Ryan's kids are running around here somewhere," Pam said. "That was Claire carrying the flowers."
She corrected herself, kissing Ryan on the cheek.
"Sorry, sweetie, our kids."
She caught Amit's eye, as if to say, "Can you believe I'm a stepmother?"
So this was a second marriage for Ryan. Another woman's children involved. The long-faced girl in the wedding procession was now Pam's stepdaughter. It was not what Amit would have predicted for Pam, such complications. Pam, who could have had any man.
"I was really hoping to see your girls," Pam said. "Do you have a picture?"
Megan looked in her bag, but she was carrying a small beaded evening purse and had left her wallet in the hotel room.
"I've got some," Amit said.
He flipped to two pictures, each taken when Maya and Monica were newborns, their eyes beady, their mouths drawn to fine points.
"They look nothing like that now."
"You'll have to bring them to LA. You'll all have to come stay with us at Ryan's beach house," she laughed. "I mean, our beach house."
"We'd love that," Megan said. But Amit knew it would never happen, that this was the end of the road, that there would never be a reason for him to step into Pam's world again.
"There's a brunch tomorrow on campus," Pam said. "We'll see you there."
She said it in her old way, looking at Amit as if there was something of extreme urgency she needed to discuss with him. Notes for an exam they were about to take together, or an analysis of his latest college infatuation.
"Of course," he told her.
"It's great of you to come, Amit. It's so good to see you," Pam said. For a moment, he felt a flicker of their old bond, their odd friendship. He had always been devoted to her, more so, she'd once admitted, than even her brothers, and he felt that she was acknowledging that again, now, in her glance.
"We wouldn't have missed it," he said. The line pushed them along into the crowd of the party. Megan said she needed to use the restroom. "Do you know where one is?"
He looked around. Across the lawn where people stood eating hors d'oeuvres was the admissions building, a massive Victorian mansion with wraparound porches. The double doors at the back were open and waiters dashed in and out with their trays. He remembered going there with his parents being interviewed by an unpleasant man named Mr. Plotkin. Mr. Plotkin had asked Amit why he wanted to attend Langford, and because his parents were sitting outside the room, Amit had replied truthfully that his parents were moving to India and didn't want him to go to school there.
"I'm afraid that reply isn't the mark of a Langford boy, Mr. Sarkar," Mr. Plotkin told him across the desk where Amit's report cards and recommendations lay. Then he folded his hands together and waited until Amit had provided a more adequate reply.
"There's probably bathrooms in there," he said now to Megan.
He walked with her, still positioned faithfully at her left toward the building, but inside, they discovered a long line for the ladies' room.
"What should we do?" Megan whispered.
"Well, I can't wait in that line with you. It's all women. I'm sure no one will notice the skirt."
"You think?"
She fiddled with her purse, adjusting her wrist so that the purse rested over the burnt material. Over the skirt, she was wearing a white buttoned shirt open to reveal part of a pink camisole below. Her neck was bare. She never wore the jewels his mother had given her eventually that were too ornate for her taste.
"You look great," he said.
He meant it. But he hadn't told her yet.
"I'll get us more drinks and meet you back here."
"Another lemonade?"
"Okay."
He left her there, still fiddling with the purse. It took him longer than he expected to get the drinks. The line at the bar contained a few of his old teachers, most of them in advanced middle age, a few looking on the brink of retirement. There was Mrs. Randall, his physics teacher, to whom he waved, and Mr. Plotkin, whose eyes he avoided. Then he saw Mr. Nagel, one of his English teachers, who'd also been the advisor for the school newspaper, the Langford Legend, that Amit wrote for and eventually edited. Mr. Nagel had been one of the youngest members of the faculty just out of college when Amit was a student, and he still looked refreshingly young, his dark hair and drooping mustache reminding Amit of a shorter, thinner version of Ringo Starr. Mr. Nagel was originally from Winchester, a graduate of the high school there, and Amit always felt a connection with him because of that. "Let me guess, you're writing for the New York Times," Mr. Nagel said. "Actually, I work for a medical journal." "Is that right? I didn't think you were interested in the sciences." He hadn't been. He'd wanted to be a journalist, it was true. He had loved working on the 8-page weekly paper, loved going with Mr. Nagel and the rest of the editorial staff to the offices of the local town paper once a week to do the layout. He remembered sitting in the library thinking up story ideas, interviewing members of the faculty and the famous people who sometimes came to Langford to speak at assemblies. Taking an active reporter's interest in the life of the school had helped him to endure the fact that he hated it there. But he knew that journalism wasn't an option as a career, that his parents would never indulge such thinking. It was the one battle he hadn't had the courage to fight. His parents' expectation that he go to medical school, their assumption that he become a doctor like his father. He'd had the aptitude for science, and so he'd gone ahead with it, majoring in biology at Columbia and then starting medical school there. He lasted 2 years, mainly because he met Megan and fell in love with her. But the more he got to know her, the clearer it became that he lacked her dedication, her drive. One night, in the middle of studying for a pharmacy exam, he'd gone out for a cup of coffee. He walked a few blocks to stretch his legs, and then a few more. He kept walking down Broadway, 100 blocks from his dorm in Washington Heights to Lincoln Center, and then continuing all the way to Chinatown, where at daybreak, feeling close to delirious, he finally stopped. Fish and vegetables were being unloaded from trucks, life creeping back onto the streets. He entered a bakery, had hot tea and coconut bread, watched a group of Chinese women sitting at a round table at the back sorting through a mountain of spinach. He took the train back uptown, slept through his exam. He began to cut one class, then another. A week went by, and in spite of his total passivity, he felt that he was accomplishing the greatest feat of his life. He dropped out, not telling his parents until the semester ended. He expected Megan to break up with him, but she'd respected his decision and remained. On a lark, after dropping out of med school, he applied to the journalism school at Columbia, but was not accepted. Megan urged him to write anyway, to work freelance and to put together some clips. But the job at the medical journal was easier, more predictable work. It demanded less of him, and Amit could no longer imagine doing anything else.
"I had you pegged as a newspaper man," Mr. Nagel said. "We won that wonderful award the year you graduated, never managed to win it again. They still have the plaque up in the library."
A third person joined them, a man who was introduced to Amit as the newly appointed director of alumni affairs. He took an immediate interest in Amit, asking whether he planned to attend the next reunion, talking about plans for Langford's new gymnasium.
Excuse me, Amit said when there was a pause in the conversation. I need to find my wife.
He realized that in the course of talking to Mr. Nagel, he'd finished his drink and now had only the one for Megan. So he stood in the line again and got another spiked lemonade. He began to weave among the guests, going into the admissions building, looking for her. But she wasn't there. And he realized she'd probably gone out to look for him. It was getting dark, and the only lit-up area was the tent where they would all sit to dine. When he found Megan, she was talking to Ted Schultz, her left hand still placed strategically over her skirt. The sight of Ted made Amit feel foolish all over again for calling him by the wrong name.
"I got you this," Amit said, handing Megan the lemonade.
"Oh." She looked at the drink, shaking her head. There was a glass of champagne in her other hand. "I got this off a tray.
I was just telling Megan about what it was like here when we were students," Ted said, "before these ugly new buildings went up. Where did you live?"
"Ingalls, my first year, and then Harkness." He felt unsure about the names, as if they too might be incorrect.
"Guess what?"
Megan said. Our cell phone doesn't work up here. I tried to call the girls, but there's no service.
I'm sure there's a payphone somewhere, Amit said.
I'll call them before their bedtime. He was tired of standing, longed for the opportunity to sit down and fill his stomach with something solid. A few elderly people were already under the tent, along with some mothers nursing their babies, and he wondered if it would be improper of him to take his seat as well. He waited for a gap in Ted and Megan's conversation to suggest going to their table, but then he felt a tap on the back and turned to see Pam's parents. He proceeded to catch up with them, congratulating them, pulling out his wallet again and showing the pictures of the girls. They look just like their mother, Mrs. Borden said in her usual forthright way. When he turned back to Megan, he saw that her champagne glass was empty. She had moved closer to Ted, and her hand was playing with her diamond earring, a habit of hers when she was nervous. Could it be that Megan was flirting with Ted? Instead of being jealous, Amit felt oddly liberated, relieved of his responsibility to Megan, to show her a good time. His head was pounding. He needed a glass of water, needed to dilute the alcohol that had rushed too quickly into his brain. The evening had barely begun, but it was as if he had been drinking for hours. Then he saw that the hand by Megan's ear was the one that had been formerly concealing her skirt. Now that she had had a few drinks herself, she no longer cared, and Amit realized he was free of his duty to stand by her side. At dinner, they were seated at a table with three other couples. Two of them were friends of Ryan's from California, and after introductions were made, they talked among themselves. The women were in their 50s, both dressed in silk jackets and with heavy pieces of silver jewelry, and Amit suspected they had something to do with television. The men were dark-haired and voluble and seemed to be very old friends. The other couple was engaged to be married. The woman, Felicia, was a friend of Pam's, and her fiancé's name was Jared. Jared was an architect with very fair, wispy hair, who seemed to be faintly smiling at everyone and everything until Amit realized it was the set expression of his face, his thin mouth permanently pulled back at the corners. Jared's current commission was a new wing in a hospital, and he and Megan immediately fell into conversation, Megan telling him all the things that needed to be improved, in her opinion, when it came to the design of hospitals. As their wine and water glasses were filled and a salmon tureen was served, Felicia talked to Amit about her and Jared's wedding plans. She was a petite woman, her girlish figure encased in a high-necked beige sleeveless dress. Her features, though pleasant, seemed too small for her face, as if yet to fill it up properly. The distance between the bottom of her nose and her top lip, distracting.